It's the Marketplace Tech Podcast for December 2nd. I'm Ben Johnson in New York. If I asked you which network was spending $90 million on 10 episodes of a television show, would your first guess be Netflix? The video streaming company has had its sights on emerging markets abroad, but so far it's been missing targets on getting new subscribers to sign up. It hopes a new television show about the merchant explorer Marco Polo will help Netflix hawk its goods. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Netflix's growth in the U.S. is slowing, and the potential for new subscribers is now outside the United States. That means
when they're making programming decisions, they got to make sure that the content that they have plays in as many territories as possible.
Andrew Wallenstein is co-editor-in-chief at Variety. He says Marco Polo needs to create a big buzz that could convince foreigners to sign up for a Netflix subscription. But, says media analyst Max Dawson, Netflix also has to keep those subscribers month after month.
One way of doing that is by investing in content that will be exclusive to the platform.
And for Netflix, that hasn't always been the case. Its original series, House of Cards, aired on competing networks internationally. But with Marco Polo, Netflix owns all international rights. Dawson thinks the $90 million investment could pay off.
Or it could be rejected by global viewers who see it for what it is. Content being dictated by a corporation's global expansionist ambitions.
The series will be available for worldwide binging on December 12th. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Amazon had to dole out $20 gift cards to customers after missing delivery estimates last holiday season, but we now have a glimpse of how the e-commerce giant hopes to avoid a repeat this year. Robots, obviously. Journalists were permitted into one of Amazon's gargantuan fulfillment centers this week to observe Kiva Systems, a.k.a. the almost $800 million program of warehouse robots designed to work with humans and increase efficiency. CNET.com editor-in-chief Lindsay Turrentine is here to tell us more. Lindsay, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good, but color me skeptical. What are these Amazon robots really doing?
They are these 300-plus pound robots that look like giant robot vacuums. And they scoot around. They wedge themselves under these very tall shelving systems and then lift the shelves up and bring them to the employees who are packing the products into boxes to send out to customers.
How much human-robot interaction is really happening here when the robots deliver these shelves?
I would say that there's actually more robot-to-robot interaction because The robots use sensors. They move around each other, and if something falls off a shelf, they all tell each other, wait, don't go over there. There's something sitting on the ground in your way. The people are actually just pulling the products off the shelf once the robot has left the shelf there.
How long until the sedentary humans are replaced by packing robots?
Amazon says that because these robots have increased efficiency, they've actually been able to hire more humans.
Wait, do you believe them, Lindsay? Come on.
They haven't said how many more humans they've hired, And we don't know if this is seasonal hiring.
Okay.
We also know that Amazon is working on technology to grasp and lift. I mean, and right now, if you think about what those humans in the packing centers are doing, they're essentially just finding the right product, sticking it in the box. It doesn't take a huge leap of imagination to think that once a robot can do that too, then things get kind of dicey for that job.
What does this make you think about?
I would really worry more about the loss of human jobs to robots, maybe not in the very near term, but it gets you thinking about how this could all play out. These robots themselves, they really are fun to watch. They look like giant Roombas, except squarer. So they look like a robot vacuum. They're not scary looking, I'll tell you that.
Okay, but those are the ones you really have to watch out for. Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET.com. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case about whether threats of violence on Facebook should be protected under the First Amendment. The particular case in front of the court dealt with an estranged husband who talked about killing his wife online. We wanted to take a closer look at the legal nuances of harassment and hate speech on the internet. Danielle Citrin is law professor at the University of Maryland and the author of the book Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
What's the difference between offline and online hate speech, or is there one?
I don't think there should be one. So often the context includes both offline and online speech, and we should look at it all together.
Can you talk a little bit about how the internet and other new technology has changed the nature of these kinds of threats?
The internet is sort of a force multiplier. It provides so many more opportunities for people to harass and threaten. And at the same time, it sort of spreads those, you know, the threats and harassment far and wide, and we can't escape them. So you can't escape a threatening tweet in the way that we used to be able to shut our doors, leave disruptive forces in our lives behind, and escape.
And also, I would imagine it's easier for people to target a single user with a relatively safe cloak of anonymity.
And they do so, and so often it's so destructive because people feel like they're not going to get caught. And even if they're caught, that law enforcement won't do anything about it. And that's the great difficulty.
How do you fix this?
I think if we were to enforce laws that we already have on the books, threat laws, harassment and stalking laws, we can make a measure of success and deterrence. Law certainly can't do it all. It certainly can't. It's a blunt instrument.
Well, it's also, we also live in a country that really values the First Amendment.
And I think that's right. If we're talking about hate speech, that is hateful words about groups, but not threatening to a specific individual, then as a country, we are committed to protecting speech, ugly, offensive, nasty, because the idea is, look, there can be counter speech. But when it comes to targeted threats and harassment of individuals, there really is no counter speech that's effective. What do you say to someone who threatens to rape you? Don't rape me? But you're right, our First Amendment tradition commits us to a certain level of offensive speech that we do live with. And we know that counter speech can provide some alleviation of the problem, but it really can't for targeted harassment of individuals.
Danielle Citrin is law professor at the University of Maryland, and she's the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Where and how do you think the line should be drawn? Let us know at facebook.com/marketplacetech. I'm Ben Johnson, and that's our show today. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.